Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Joyce Vance, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Jill Wine Banks. We have an exciting show for you today. We're going to go cross-country, starting in Georgia and Florida, with all the things happening in those cases for Trump. Then we're going to talk about the threats and political violence that have become, unfortunately, frequent in our country. And then we're going to go over to New York to talk about more of what's happening with Trump. But I want to first talk about how important it is for listeners and everyone they know to vote for Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. We are in the podcast category for news and politics. The link is in the show notes and all over our social media platforms, so you can find it from any one of us and from Politicon. And it's something really important to us. It's a big honor to be nominated, but it would be an even bigger honor to win. And then we also want you to go to politicon.com/tour because we are going to be in Chicago on May 2nd, Detroit on May 9th, and Boston on May 30th. We're going to be doing this show live and answering your questions live when you stand up in the audience and ask them. So we know you're going to want to go. So go to politicon.com/tour. And let me just, before we start the serious stuff, can I ask you all to talk about what the Webby nomination means? And by the way, for our listeners who don't know, the Webbies are the Oscars of the podcast world. Kim, what do you think?
Oh, it's so exciting. It's always wonderful to be nominated. But it really would be better if we win. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I really think that we have done some good work on this podcast. I'm immensely proud of it. And that sort of recognition won't just feel great, but it'll help other people find it. And I think this year, this podcast is probably more important than it ever has been.
I mean, Kim, I think that's absolutely right. For me right now, it's really important that we bring more people into the Hashtag Sisters-in-Law family because we've got important times ahead of us. And we hear so much good feedback from our listeners. But, you know, I'll tell you what made me feel really great this week. After we found out we had been nominated and we posted about it on social media, it was seeing so many of our listeners saying, of course I voted for you. I just voted for you. I'm so excited to have been able to vote for you. And it made me feel something that I feel every Friday afternoon when we get together, which is that we're a family.
Yeah, you know, I've been on the road with this book tour, and when I do book talks, there'll be a lot of people who show up in sisters-in-law's t-shirts, and it makes me feel really good to see those people. And, you know, one of the things I hear consistently is how they feel like they know us because they're with us every Saturday morning. And so I think that winning a Webby Award would be an achievement for our whole family of listeners, our whole family of sisters-in-law. And so I hope our audience, who we consider our sisters and brothers in the cause of justice, will be there to vote for us, and we'll win this together and honor you with that award.
So join our excitement and vote for us and tell all your friends to vote for us, post it on social media, and you can get the link directly to how to vote in our category. And of course, to vote for us in that category, either in our show notes or when we post about the show tomorrow morning, then we will also put it in our own feeds. So look for it there and please join us. Hey, Kim, I've discovered a great new product. Have you been using OneSkin?
You know, I really have, especially now that the seasons are changing and my skin always reacts when that happens. OneSkin has been really, really good. You know, there's nothing like the feeling of being confident in your own skin. And that's why we want to tell you about today's sponsor, OneSkin. Their products make it easy to keep your skin healthy while looking and feeling your best. No complicated routine, no multiple step protocols, just simple, scientifically validated solutions.
The secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS01 peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to switch off the aging cells, and God knows I need that, that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. And they have got studies to back it up. We've been using their products for a while now, and we're hooked. But don't just take our word for it. OneSkin has over 4,000 five-star reviews and were recognized by Fast Company as one of the most innovative brands in 2024. Plus, for a limited time, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your first OneSkin purchase using the code SISTERS when you check out at oneskin.co. Try OneSkin and enjoy younger, healthier skin without all the extra steps.
Their head-to-toe skin health trio is revolutionary and it gives you total coverage. It really lets you feel your best. The regimen works fast and it's quick and easy to apply. Like Kim and Jill said, no multiple steps. I really look forward to my OneSkin routine every day, and now I never go anywhere without it. We know you'll love OneSkin too.
OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using code SISTERS at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code SISTERS. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. You can find the link in our show notes.
As we get closer to the trial date in Manhattan, which we'll be talking about later in the show, things are heating up in Trump's other criminal cases, too. There were major developments this week in the Fulton County case and in the classified documents prosecution in federal court in Florida. So first we go to Georgia, where Judge McAfee had Trump's motion to dismiss the case on the table. Kim, what was the issue that Trump's lawyers raised, and how did the judge rule?
Well, Donald Trump and his co-defendants raised the issue, claiming that they could not be prosecuted because the actions they were being prosecuted for were in part speech, not just any speech, but political speech, and that the First Amendment gives broad protection for political speech, and it would have a terrible chilling effect if criminal consequences could flow from such speech. Judge McAfee said, no, that's not how it works. Yes, political speech does have broad First Amendment protection. But like other types of speech, if it becomes an element of a crime, it loses that protection. And there are a lot of different circumstances that that can take place. Is speech protected? Yes. But is perjury, lying before a court or giving a false statement to law enforcement, is that protected? No. Can you say false things under the First Amendment? Yes. But can you make false statements as part of committing fraud? No. And the same is here with the charges that they all are facing. First Amendment, in this case, if the speech was aimed at criminal activity and an essential part of that, it does not have First Amendment protection.
Yeah, Trump really loves to throw the First Amendment around. But, you know, I always think that when a bank robber walks into a bank and says, stick them up, that's not protected by the First Amendment.
You're violating my First Amendment rights, Joyce. There you go again.
Well, so what do you think, Barb? Did the judge get it right? I mean, was this the expected ruling and was it correct in all of its particulars?
Yes. In fact, this was such a ludicrous claim that I have to believe it is as much for the public as it was for the judge. I mean, certainly there are times when advocacy gets charged criminally. You know, there's the material support statute, incitement, you know, where there is a close call about whether something violates somebody's First Amendment rights. But, you know, in this case where it is demanding that people violate their oaths of office and find votes or substitute slates of electors for false electors, that's not a First Amendment right. I think sometimes people get confused because the First Amendment itself says Congress shall make no law abridging the right to free speech. But like every other provision in the Constitution, you have to read one section in concert with the rest of the Constitution. You can't read any one piece in a vacuum. And so there is this very high protection for our First Amendment rights. It doesn't mean they're absolute, just like everything else. And the standard the courts look at when there is some impingement on a fundamental right like free speech is a standard referred to as strict scrutiny, which means that the limitation must be narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling governmental interest. So when it comes to things like, you know, crimes, as Kim just said, threats and fraud and conspiracy and all those kinds of things, they all implicate speech, but because there's a compelling governmental reason in preventing those kinds of crimes and the restriction is narrowly tailored to address them, It is not a violation of the First Amendment rights of free speech. And so we see that in lots of different contexts. And I think the judge absolutely got it right. But you know what this does? And the reason I say it was written for the public is it allows Trump to say, they're violating my rights of free speech, my First Amendment rights. And to people who are not, deeply steeped in the law, that probably sounds pretty good at a superficial level. And so I think it just gives him a little bit of ammunition for his grievances.
But it could have backfired, well, it may still, in a terrible way, because by arguing, hey, this is political speech, I'm engaging in political speech, it runs completely contrary to the argument he's making right now before the U.S. Supreme Court in the immunity case, right, where right. he's arguing, I was acting in my official capacity.
Right, right.
I was acting
job.
As president.
Just
I was doing my job. Like, well, which one is it?
Yeah.
Because one, I mean, it can't be both. You can't win both. You can lose both. And I think he will, but you can't have it both. I mean, that just shows you how disingenuous the argument even was.
Yeah, and can I interject just one thing, Kim, to build on what you just said, because it's so important, and that is this idea that consistency doesn't matter. In fact, inconsistency is part of the Trump playbook. This is part of, I write about this in my book, this is part of what Steve Bannon talks about flooding the zone with garbage. He uses the term, a profane term, but flooding the zone with all of this inconsistent stuff. Part of it is just to exhaust us that, you know, who knows what the truth is? Who knows which way is up? I hear this, I hear that. I've given up trying. And that's the goal, ultimately, is to exhaust us with all of these different views of inconsistent claims.
Well, if we ever made a T-shirt that was like hashtag sisters-in-law's list of stupidest motions Donald Trump has ever filed, this
the
one definitely
list,
would have to make the list. It is. It's highly competitive, but I think this one makes the cut. You know, there's still not a trial date in Georgia, and we don't expect one while the defendant's efforts to disqualify Fannie Willis are working their way through the appeal process. So that's sort of Georgia for the week. Now, since it's spring break down in the South, at least, we can head on to Florida, where there was a pretty big development this week. Jill, why don't I start with you and talk with us about what the issue was and how Judge Cannon just ruled in her most recent order.
So, Joyce, before I answer your question, I just want to say that that T-shirt you're talking about with all the silly motions is going to have to become in only an extra, extra large, extra long. There's no way else.
Very good. Okay, the maxi dress. The hashtag sisters-in-law maxi dress.
Ball gown.
That's it. Okay. I want that dress. Definitely.
I wish I could have that for the White House correspondence dinner.
That would be great. Down. Sure would beat I don't really care as a symbol.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so back
okay,
to
your
Florida.
Answer, please.
Okay, serious answer. Cannon's ruling is absurd because although the headlines are saying that it's a victory for Smith, it sort of is and it sort of definitely isn't. And I'm more on the it isn't side. What she said is, okay, it's not a pretrial dismissal motion. I'm not going to rule on that until during the trial, after the evidence, after the defense has been put in. And that leaves Jack Smith in a Hobson's choice, which I had to look up to make sure I was using that correctly, by the way.
Well
done. Because it means that he either has to act now to force her to make a decision, because if he waits and lets her do it during the trial, jeopardy will have attached, double jeopardy will prevent any conviction after that. So if the jury is sworn and evidence is presented, jeopardy attaches, and then that's the end of the case if she dismisses it. If the jury reaches a verdict of not guilty, it's also over. But it doesn't have to get to the jury. It can be dismissed by her, and that's the fear that I have and that I think many of us have, is that by her ruling saying, not pre-trial, I think that he either has to mandamus her on something or he has to, in some other way, get to the appellate court. A motion in limine might do it to limit the possibility of his raising evidence on the Presidential Records Act. And I know we're going to talk about that in a little while. This was definitely part of it. And as someone who lived through its creation as a result of Richard Nixon trying to personalize and take away the Watergate tapes and other documents, and take, by the way, a financial benefit from it, I know that the PRA does not apply to this case at all. So, Joyce, I also mentioned two legal terms that we don't usually talk in Latin on the show, although I love when we do. But let me just explain what I was talking about. Mandamus is a way for a litigant to force the judge to do something by going to an appellate court saying it is her obligation to rule on something. Please make her do it, or in this case, her, could be a him. A motion in limine is a motion before trial to say what evidence will be precluded. It's in limine is like limiting it. You cannot introduce certain evidence. And so I think that's another way that Jack Smith can prevent the defense from trying to get the jury to have the power to say what is and what isn't personal documents. That's not a question of fact. That's a legal question under the Presidential Records Act. And so I think limiting the evidence through a motion in limine and then appealing if Judge Cannon does not grant that motion, which she clearly should, appealing that denial of his motion in limine. If he gets it, then it's fine. They can't use that. So that's what I meant by that. Either force her to rule, which she hasn't really done yet. She has sort of said, oh, I'm going to wait till the trial. Then it's too late and he can't appeal. We can't let that happen.
So Jack Smith was thrown a lemon and you're saying he should make in limine.
Oh, ooh, nice.
Bravo.
Nice.
Well, so, you know, this is also very confusing. I've talked to a lot of people struggling to keep this straight. The issue that the judge ruled on most recently, the order she issued, was on her own motion asking both sides to file jury instructions. And those jury instructions assumed that the Presidential Records Act was a defense that Trump could use in this case. But Kim, I think we need to back up a step, right, and figure out how did we get there. For one thing, I don't know, Barb, maybe your experience was different. For me, we usually submitted jury instructions right before trial, sometimes not till we were in the middle of trial with the judge asked for them.
Yeah.
Here we are, we don't even have a trial date, and out of the blue, the judge asks for these crazy trial instructions. So, Kim, I think what we need to think about is, you know, let's back up. How did we get here? Why was she ordering jury instructions about the Presidential Records Act?
Yeah, that's a great question. Why she did that on her own. It, as you mentioned, it was crazy. It was crazy for two reasons. The one that you mentioned is the timing of it. I mean, we don't even have a trial date, let alone a jury pool, let alone a jury selected, let alone anybody to give these proposed jury instructions to. And secondly, as we've mentioned before, it's important to remember you have the Espionage Act. That is what Trump is being charged under. That act governs the retention and maintaining of classified documents, sensitive documents that need to be kept in a certain way, in a certain secure location under government control. And Donald Trump is charged with doing the exact opposite of that. The Presidential Records Act is a separate statute that governs notes that the president takes, you know, correspondence that he makes, things like that. Now, that too, presidential records generally also have to be turned over to the government, and it's kept by the National Archives, totally separate. But a president can say, hey, you know what, that actually was a note to a friend of mine. That wasn't anything I was doing in my job. That is a personal record. I would like those back. And then the National Archive can return those records. He is claiming that these classified documents were presidential records that belonged to him. There is no statute that provides that a classified document, certainly the one that governs presidential notes, does not supersede the one about classified documents. But she seems not to understand that because she asked the parties to write proposed jury instructions based on whether she rules that it does apply, that the Presidential Records Act does supply a defense, and one if they don't, which is just nutty. Nutty. Why she took it upon herself to do that. I have a list. I don't know if you guys have read the piece by David Latt that talked actually about her clerks that left and the change in the atmosphere, according to clerks that have worked for her since getting this case and what it was like before. I think based on that, it makes sense to me that she is in over her head.
Yeah.
Do I think that she's a MAGA activist? No. Do I think she's unintelligent? No. But do I think she doesn't know what she's doing? Yes. I think it's a combination of the pressure of the high profile nature of this might be getting to her. And also, she's never done this before. Again, I defend new judges. Every judge is new at some point. But when you clearly are showing time and time again that you don't know what you are doing and that you are over your head, I'm with Jill. It's time for Jack Smith to mandamus up and do something about this because it's just too much.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, the reason that we had this little, sideshow going on this week was because she just refused to rule on Trump's motion to dismiss the case under the Presidential Records Act. He filed the motion. It was fully briefed. She held a hearing. She doesn't rule. Out of the blue, we get this crazy request for jury instructions. And so it's, who knows what the explanation right. is. I mean, I will say she was in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of Florida when she was in AUSA. They have one of the finest appellate divisions in the country. You don't get into that appellate division by being a slouch. So presumably she has not only considerable smarts and experience, she also has plenty of people she could call on for advice. I think that makes a lot of what we're seeing here just really inexplicable. So, Barb, what do you think? Was this an expected or a correct ruling from her?
So the part where she denies the motion to dismiss on the basis of the presidential records case is correct. It was a little slow. I mean, this is another one of those, you got to be kidding me, defenses that should have been summarily
dismissed. Put it on the dress.
Yeah, but it goes on the dress, it goes on the gown. So the idea that she was like dithering with it for so long is one of the things that does cause you to scratch your head. Is she just in the bag for Trump? Or I tend to agree with Kim that she's either just so inexperienced or so incompetent that she didn't quite know what to do with this. And the request for the jury instructions was also very odd. Joyce, to your point, asking about when do jury instructions typically get handled? In the Eastern District of Michigan, there was a standing order that went out in every case that said joint jury instructions should be filed 3 days before the commencement of trial. So no trial date has even been set yet. So if trial had been set for, I guess what, May 20th, is May 25th off now? It was at one time May 25th.
It is off, yeah.
Well, it's off. So let's just say hypothetically
it was, yeah.
It's still officially on for May 25th. So 3 days before that, that's probably a Tuesday. I haven't looked at a calendar, but we used to start trials on Tuesdays. Three business days before May 25th. And May 25th is actually a Saturday. All right, that's... So
that's
anybody
weird.
Ever check? Did anybody ever look at that? Trial's not starting that day. But 3 days before that is when the parties would submit proposed preliminary instructions. And then, of course, if things changed in the trial, you might have an instruction. I would always include a proposed instruction if the defendant does testify and a proposed instruction if the defendant doesn't testify because they have a right to either of those things. And then, of course, you use the one that applies and those kinds of things. So I think that the idea that she's now talking about these jury instructions is very, very strange. I think the other thing is I would agree with Jill, and I've done this, I bet all of you have in some way, at least when you're representing the government in a criminal case, those of you who've been in this situation, to file these motions in limine well in advance of the trial so that you can appeal if you need to pre-trial. So for example, I can recall a time when I had a case involving somebody who was acting as an agent of a foreign government spying against the United States. And we had documents that had been retrieved from that foreign government's intelligence service. And those documents were really the whole case. There were some other facts, but if those documents were not admitted into evidence, there is no way we would win that case. The documents were critical to the case. So we filed an advance motion for a pretrial ruling on admissibility, and it required a hearing. We had a full day hearing on these documents, and we brought in a witness and an expert, and they were cross-examined, and the judge looked at all of them. And at the end of that hearing, she made a ruling that the documents were admissible. And that was important because if she had rejected it, I still had a chance to appeal that decision before jeopardy attached when the jury was seated. Conversely, we had another case where there was a home invasion robbery ring, where a group of people were traveling from Texas around the country, including into Michigan, where they were robbing homes. Typically, they were small business owners who were immigrants from another country on the theory that they'd have a lot of cash in their homes and would be unlikely to use banks. And so they'd have a young woman ring the doorbell after dark. And when the person opened the door, four guys would jump out of the bushes with masks and zip tie everybody in the house and steal all their money and jewelry and everything else. They also targeted people who had kids because they thought they wouldn't fight back. Isn't that so dastardly? But one of the key pieces of evidence in this case were the text messages between the members of the crew and their mastermind back in Texas, who was saying, here's the house. What does it look like? I'm looking at it online. It's a red brick house. Here's the address, et cetera, et cetera. So those text messages were critically important to the case. Again, filed a motion for a pretrial ruling. The judge rejected them, said that they contained hearsay and were inadmissible. And so we said we got to take this up on appeal because these messages we think are admissible. We think they satisfy the rules of evidence, but they're such an essential part of the case. We don't think we can win the case without them. So we appealed. It took about a year, by the way, to appeal the case before it came back for trial. But the Court of Appeals reversed, said the documents were admissible, the text messages, and they came in. But there was a cost to it, and that was this year-long delay. And so, again, I don't know whether Judge Cannon is acting out of an effort to assist Donald Trump or merely her own incompetence, but this route of appeal is something that Jack Smith should avail himself of if necessary, but it's going to cost him a lot of time.
Well, I mean, that's to the point, right, isn't it? Because there's been a lot of dispute among legal experts about what the special counsel's office needs to do to protect this case. And the concern is that Judge Cannon just keeps kicking the can down the road, not just on the Presidential Records Act, but on a lot of possible motions. And Jill, to your point early on, that's the real problem for prosecutors because of the legal doctrine of double jeopardy, which prevents prosecutors from trying the same defendant twice on the same charges. So once the jury has been sworn in, we prosecutors say that double jeopardy has attached, which means that after that point, if the jury acquits, or more significantly here, if the judge dismisses a case against a defendant, it's all over. The government can't appeal even if she makes a really bad decision and the case is at an end. So the government, like in Barb's example, really wants the judge to rule on these issues before trial. With the Presidential Records Act issue, if she rules against them now, prosecutors can take that appeal, even if it takes a year. And her strategy seems to be to keep them from appealing her bad decisions. So, you know, that's the problem Jack Smith faces and that we're debating and other analysts are debating. And I'm wondering what y'all think. What's the right approach for Jack Smith to take here? Is it an appeal with delay or something else? Jill, what do you think?
Well, to follow up on what you're saying and what Barb just said, when I was explaining this to my husband today, I went through my rationale. And when I mentioned I think he's got a Hobson's choice, it is he's going to trade off a delay if he has to do mandamus should be decided quickly. So that's sort of an attractive thing because the court probably will decide it quickly and then force her to take action. But he cannot, I think, in my opinion, it's the right thing to do. There's no way that he can take the risk of starting the trial without a ruling and have her do something that will bar his ever being convicted on this crime. So I think it's sort of a no-brainer that he has to either file a motion in limine or a mandamus action to get a ruling before the jury is impaneled. So that's sort of how I went through my logic of whatever delay it takes, it's better than her acquitting him basically after the jury is sworn.
Barb, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I would go this route that we've discussed of, I think he needs to file one more thing, which is this motion in limine to preclude Donald Trump from raising the Presidential Records Act in any way whatsoever is completely irrelevant to this case. Because what she said in her order is, I don't know, maybe he'll raise it as a defense. We'll have to wait and see. Because once the jury is sworn, as we've just said, it's going to be too late to appeal. So I think you file this motion to preclude any defense, any reference whatsoever to the Presidential Records Act. And then when she decides that, that's when you appeal. One thing he could do, or she could do, is try to sit on that and stall. But there is, our friend Mary McCord pointed this out to us, Joyce, I'm sure you saw this, that Rule 12D says that the judge can't wait and must decide the case pretrial to prevent this idea of delay beyond which point the prosecution can file an appeal. So
yeah,
I think
they
can force her to make that decision.
That's the rule, but I think the judge has already preempted that, because what she says in this order, and this is the part that makes me think maybe she's venal but smart, she makes the point that some of these issues aren't ready to be decided, that she needs to hear the evidence before she can rule. Now, I disagree with her. I don't think that's the case, but she's sort of teed it up that way, which makes it difficult to get mandamus. Boy, we're really in the weeds here, but
no,
mandamus is a writ where Andrea Mitchell said this when I was on with her earlier this week, and I thought it was the best description of mandamus I've ever heard. She said, it's an order from the court to a judge to do your job. They can't tell the judge how to rule or what their substantive ruling should be. It has to be a purely ministerial duty right. that the court has failed to do. So if she doesn't rule, they can say, you must rule. They can't tell her how to rule. And it has to be a situation where she's obligated to rule. And I'm worried that it's just not clear enough here. And I have to say, what I would lean towards is a motion asking her to clarify her ruling. What do you mean, judge? Are you saying you can't do this again at trial? And then I would just go straight up with a motion asking her to recuse. She has to file a written response, and they can take it to the 11th Circuit. It's certainly not the best, you know, strategy, but this is a break glass moment. Kim, what do you think? Am I out on the ledge again? What would you do here?
I was going to say, well, man, damn it. I was going to say that was going to be my way to go, but I guess I agree with Barb now.
Man, damn it.
Man, damn it. I mean, this is a tough one, right? This shows us the power that a judge has. And we're used to judges, even when we don't agree with them, right? It's not that we think that they're crazy. There's just more than one legitimate approach, and they've picked one. That's their job as a judge. Here, you know, you can see different possibilities. And then Judge Cannon just takes a big old right turn and ends off out in, you know, like some rural Florida swamp county. And you just can't figure out what she's doing.
All right, we just got a bunch of wild grain, right?
We did.
Yeah. It's so exciting when that box shows up. My family like oohs and ahs.
Barb, I have one word for you. Croissant.
We've had croissants. We've had various kinds of breads. There's cookies, pasta. It's really amazing. Whenever I want to make our meal shine at that next level, wild grain's the first thing I think of. The Bavarian pretzel buns are the perfect way to start a meal, especially on a game day. Their pastas and pastries are amazing too. There's such a great variety.
Now you have me wanting to say, Bavarian pretzels in my best Homer Simpson imitation. I really love watching the color and flavor come alive when the pecan sticky buns are heating up in the oven. That's my current favorite. And the funny thing is, I don't have to call my family when the baked goods are ready because they smell it and they descend on the kitchen like a horde of locusts. You know, as soon as the smell reaches them, they all come down running. Wild grain items are easy to prepare. You just preheat the oven and pop them in, and 20 minutes later, out they come. They're absolutely delicious. Easy and delicious, that's the perfect combination. You'll want to try everything they have to offer. I certainly have.
I think all of us feel like it's Christmas and Hanukkah combined when the Wild Grain box arrives. It's the first ever Bake From Frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, my favorite is Tannarelli, and artisanal pastries. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less. No thawing required. Plus, you can now fully customize your Wild Grain box so you can choose any combination of breads, pastas, and pastries. You can even build a box of only breads, only pastas, or only pastries if you'd like. We know you'll love everything they have to offer.
Jill, the latest, my latest order of Wild Grain came on my birthday, so I know what you meant. Like, that was the best present ever.
Yeah, for sure.
And for a limited time, you can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box. I have to tell you how good the croissants are. I am not kidding around. They were better than they were in France. And you get that when you go to wildgrain.com/sisters to start your subscription. You heard me, free croissants, every box, and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/sisters. That's wildgrain.com/sisters. Or you can use the promo code sisters at checkout. Or you can look for the link, as always, in our show notes.
Well, as these Trump cases gear up for trial and the election draws closer, we're seeing threats along with words and imagery of political violence. Last Friday, Donald Trump posted a video on his Truth Social platform that showed a pickup truck. Did you guys see this? With a Trump flag driving down the highway. And the back of the pickup truck, you know, that where the bed of the truck is, what do we call that? The tailgate? The gate was up, but it was painted to make it appear that Joe Biden was lying in the back of the truck with his arms and legs bound hogtied style. I mean, it's really a disturbing picture. And I wanted to talk about these, I don't know, threats, jokes, imagery of political violence, and what might be the consequences of all of these things. So Joyce, you wrote an interesting piece about this in your Civil Discourse Substack. What do you see as some of the dangers and consequences of an image like this being posted by Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think the dangers are obvious, and sadly the consequences, that there have been no consequences, right? I would have thought that at a minimum, the Secret Service would have had a conversation with their protectee, the former president, and he would have removed that image from his social media feed. But you know, it's still there. It is still there for people to see. And you may recall that early in Trump's presidency, when the comedian Kathy Griffin posted a picture of herself holding what was obviously a fake but grotesque severed head that looked like Trump, she got immediate visits from law enforcement and the Secret Service. She faced, you know, difficult measures trying to do things like flying. I think TSA had her on a list for a while, and she was essentially canceled from working, fired from multiple jobs. But not with Trump. No consequences. And we know how his party would respond if Biden did anything approaching this. But Trump has been given a complete and total pass for very dangerous conduct.
Yeah, Kim, you have any thoughts about that? You know, the comments of Biden's campaign team obviously was outraged and thought it was terrible. And Trump's campaign team just said things like, well, what Biden's doing is worse because he's got all these prosecutors prosecuting Donald Trump, you know, which of course is just not true either. So what are your thoughts about this?
I mean, I think it's very much akin to what you talked about in your book about sort of the slow creep of disinformation. The more you come to accept disinformation, it makes it easier to accept more. This is very similar. This is normalizing political violence in a way that makes the next thing, the next horrible thing that he does, which is even worse, seem not as bad. And then eventually we're just calling it, oh, that's just Trump being Trump. But that is how authoritarianism takes hold. That is how the seeds for political violence are sown. We already know Donald Trump was behind January 6th. We've already seen it happen. And it just is really shocking to me that it is happening again in plain sight. And as of now, there has not only not been any accountability for it, but as Joyce says, it's still up as we record on his site.
Yeah. What about you, Jill? Do you have any thoughts about this as well? I mean, am I overreacting to think that this is an absolutely terrifying visual image for a president to be posting?
You are not overreacting. And I agree with what Joyce and Kim said. And I would also say you're not overreacting because it was a very effective trompe-l'oeil. I mean, I actually, when I first saw the picture of it, thought that that was actually inside the bed of the truck as opposed to on the tailgate, which was closed. I mean, it was very, very efficient. And I think, and Kim, you probably agree, as someone who is a wordsmith, that a person is responsible for the reasonable interpretation of their words. And Trump has a long history of knowing that his words have consequences, that someone will go attack an FBI office, that someone will go attack a judge, a pizza parlor. Those are things that have happened because of his words. And so when he posts something, you know, if any of us posted it, it wouldn't have the same consequences. But when he posts something like that, his followers may take violent action in response to it. And that is his responsibility, and he should be held accountable. And, you know, I think we all now know Kathy Griffin, and she's a wonderful person. She was on the no-fly list for over 5 years, and she did have her contracts cut off with CNN, and is, you know, had a long time before a comeback, which she is now making. She's back touring. And those are the same consequences that should be imposed on Donald Trump. And I mean, I remember when we first said Teflon Ron, and it's clearly double Teflon Don. And we need to make sure that he is held accountable for all of the things he does. He got away with a lot in terms of, you know, gag orders, not covering the daughter of Judge Mershon. So I just think accountability is important. And I think this was a stark and terrible image.
We also saw Trump target the daughter of Judge Juan Mershon, who is presiding over the Manhattan hush money case. And this week, the judge actually expanded his gag order to make it crystal clear that it includes family members of court personnel. But before that change, Trump posted this image of his daughter. And of course, Donald Trump has argued that these gag orders are violating his First Amendment rights. So this is a little different from the topic we talked about earlier about whether a crime can supersede First Amendment free speech rights. This is a gag order. And can we see gag orders from time to time? But to Donald Trump's point, never before have we had a candidate for president on trial. And so as a member of the press and vigorous defender of the First Amendment that you are, how do you see these gag orders?
Yeah, well, I see them as a balancing test, not completely dissimilar from what we talked about earlier with the use of First Amendment as a defense against crime. Maybe a little harder to define because it's up to a judge. A judge has to balance the interest in a robust political debate, which has very strong First Amendment protections, right? He is a candidate. And because of that, it's different than if it were you and me or me in this circumstance. But also the judge has to balance that against the ability to administer justice fairly and safely. And that includes not having the courtroom proceedings disrupted. That includes not having witnesses feel intimidated or threatened. And that also includes not having the people, the judges and others, not feel intimidated or unable to do their jobs either for fear of what it would mean to their family members. So those are two very strong competing interests. And I think in this case, especially given what Jill pointed out, is that Trump's words have had horrible consequences in the past, not the least of which was January 6th, that it gives plenty good case for imposing the gag order, making them do it as it has been in the past, as limited as you can. But every time he breaks it, you make it broader and broader and broader. He will make the case for you about how broad it needs to be. And I think in this case, that's exactly what should happen.
Oh, that's a really interesting idea. So start it narrow. And yeah, then as he demonstrates its necessity, you can add categories. Well, Jill, let me ask you about that because I actually have some concerns that maybe this order is too narrow, even as it's written. And this order very much follows the guidance of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which narrowed a gag order issued by Judge Tanya Chutkan in the federal election interference case. She had an order about not targeting, I think was her word, you know, witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, et cetera, leaving herself out, leaving the prosecutor themselves out. But one of the things the Court of Appeals did is to narrow her order. And then now in this Mershon case, he has followed suit, which says you have to show that he intended to target them in their capacity as a participant in this trial. You know, it isn't that I'm targeting Mike Pence because he's a political rival or he's refused to endorse me. I'm only targeting Mike Pence in his role as a potential witness in this case. Do you think that that is appropriate, or do you think it makes it unworkable?
I think it's both. I do. I think that it puts an unbelievable hurdle to anyone trying to enforce the gag order, because proving the mental intent of the statements is going to be very difficult. And so it kind of undermines the broadening of it to include family, or for that matter, just to protect the witnesses and the jurors, because you have to prove the intent. And that's hard. On the other hand, I do think there may be, not as to, for example, Mike Pence, but as to jurors and witnesses, you don't have to prove intent. I don't think you should have to. I think that if you say something that could bring about harm, and I think a lot of the argument that was made for the expanded gag order when Bragg asked to say, please, you know, clarify that you didn't include, and if you didn't, now include your daughter and my family, your family. It was necessary that that be done because he had already done that. It wasn't a violation, as the ruling clearly said. Mershon said, you know, it wasn't in the original thing, so you haven't violated it. But if you do, and I think he had some, you know, good language about, and one of the consequences will be you won't get to know the names of the jurors if you continue this behavior. That's a really good penalty because it's significant in putting on a defense in a case that's about to go to trial if you don't know the jurors and can't do any research on them. So I think he's, you know, setting up, there could be a fine, there could be jail. He said, you know, he set forth all of the possibilities, but I thought it was very clever to say, you have a right to the names, but you can lose that if you keep up this behavior.
Yeah.
So I think it's a serious attempt at controlling him. But as we've all seen, he's kind of uncontrollable.
Kind of. The understatement of the year. Hey, Joyce, you had an interesting take earlier in the week when you said that you thought that perhaps what Trump's goal is here in going after Mershon's daughter, which, by the way, was a false claim, right? He said that her social media account was posting a picture of him behind bars, when in fact it turns out this is not an account she's used for over a year. Somebody else has did this. That didn't, you know, no retraction from Donald Trump after the New York State Court Administrator's Office said this. But you had a theory about why he's, you know, it doesn't seem wise to go after the judge who's presiding over your case, right? That's like insulting the umpire in a baseball game. Like, you know, usually you try to treat those people pretty well. You had an interesting theory about what he might be really going on here.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess, partially a theory about why he might be doing it. Really, it's just more a concern about the real risk here, because the problem that I see is the spillover effect of Trump targeting the member of a judge's family, you know, someone who has pretty good access to protection from the kind of harassment that his followers might send her way. And I wonder how that impacts regular people, right? Potential jurors who don't have ready access to court security for the rest of their lives. It reminds me of the mafia cases. I used to do Dixie mafia cases. And sometimes jurors and witnesses got an understanding that after the case was over, they might face retaliation, depending on how they behaved. I think the bottom line here for the judge here is that he has an obligation to protect the integrity of the proceedings before him. And, you know, no one, least of all this judge, wants to give Trump the martyr status that he's trying out for. I mean, I think that's why he's pushing the limits so hard on this gag order. He's almost daring the judge to put him in jail in advance of trial so that he can then be Donald Trump, the great martyr. But at some point, the judge is going to have to take action if he's serious about the gag order, and that's going to be very difficult for him to do.
Yeah, well, one question, let me wrap up with this, which is, it's interesting to see that Donald Trump has gone after Judge Mershon in New York, gone after Judge Tanya Chutkan, the judge presiding over the federal election interference case. He's also targeted all of the prosecutors, Alvin Bragg, Jack Smith, Fani Willis, Letitia James, but not Scott McAfee in Georgia or Aileen Cannon in Florida. Why do you think that that's the case? Jill, let me start with you. I mean, I can think of some racial characteristics that are perhaps at play here, some gender characteristics, but they're not the same across the board. What do you all think are the reasons he has kind of left these two alone?
Well, it's obvious why he's left Judge Cannon alone. She's in his side, and she is doing everything she can to delay and cause disruption. So that's obvious. With the judge in Georgia, it's not so clear. He is a Republican appointee, but he hasn't really, in my mind, shown any particular bias for or against Trump, although I would say the hearing that he allowed to go forward in the Fani Willis case was definitely a benefit to Donald Trump. And so maybe he sees him as someone who might help him out a little, not necessarily out of bias. Maybe it's, you know, it's hard to know whether it's he's new to the bench. Maybe that's the reason he let this go on so long and so off target from what was possibly provable for her to have to get out of the case. I mean, it went much too much into personal stuff that had nothing to do with whether she was qualified to continue on the case. So maybe that's the reason, is that he hasn't done anything horrible to Trump yet, and so he's not attacking him yet.
I think it's easy. In Georgia, he's attacking Fani Willis, right? That's where all of his ire is going. We know exactly why. We know exactly why he's attacking the judges of color and the prosecutors of color with such vigor. And his Georgia, you say the word Georgia to him, it will take him exactly 0.5 seconds to start raging against Fani Willis. That's why McAfee is not getting a smoke.
Leave the Federalist Society judges alone.
Well, you know, one of the strategies that people have, authoritarians have, is to go after their potential critics, right? You want to undermine them in advance. That way, when they rule against you, you can say, oh, look, I told you all along they were criminals or crooks or corrupt or whatever it is. See, you know, you call the press the enemy of the people. And then when they report unfavorably to me, I say, see, I told you all along. But with these two judges, McAfee and Cannon, I think he is hoping that maybe they're going to rule in his favor. So there's no reason to undermine either of them. Joyce, are you comfortable with your shapewear?
You know, Barb, I don't wear a lot of shapewear, but sometimes we all have to. And when I do, it's always Honey Love. You should upgrade your uncomfortable shapewear like I have with today's sponsor, Honey Love. Honey Love is the go-to for all things shapewear. Their revolutionary compression technology means you won't feel trapped in your clothes. And who really wants to feel trapped? Plus, Honey Love features eye-catching design details you'll want to show off, and the fabric is breathable and cooling, too. With Honeylove, your shapewear won't ever roll down, no matter how active you are. So for a limited time only, you can get Honeylove on sale. Get 20% off your entire order with our exclusive link at honeylove.com/sisters. Support our show and check them out. honeylove.com/sisters.
Everyone wants to feel just as comfortable when they have big plans as they do every single day, which is why Honeylove's best-selling Superpower Short is a must. Its targeted compression technology and its signature X-band work with, not against, your body, and it keeps your outfit looking smooth thanks to flexible supports hidden in the side seams.
The boost bands give great lift, too. It's cotton reinforced where it matters and is easy to wear. Honeylove has more than just sculpture wear. They have super comfortable bras, tanks, and leggings for everyday support. Never feel stuck in your shapewear, which is why their products are made perfect for you. No matter what your day has in store for you, look your best with Honeylove.
You can treat yourself and save 20% off at honeylove.com/sisters. Use our exclusive link to get 20% off. honeylove.com/sisters. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Shape your life with Honeylove and look for the link in the show notes.
really like it when, as in the Georgia case we discussed, Trump's nonsensical assertions are rejected in court. And that also happened in New York this week. Barb, Trump wanted the Stormy Daniels election interference case delayed until the Supreme Court decides the presidential immunity issue. What did Judge Juan Merchan think of that request?
He was having nothing of it, Kim. Nothing to do with that. Yeah, no, he summarily got rid of it. And I think he said it in pretty strong terms, too, which I really liked because I think he sent a strong message. Now, look, this case really doesn't even implicate Trump's presidency in terms of official acts. I know he wrote some checks while he was in office, but even those are really more evidence than they are claims. I mean, the case here all happened just before the election, before he was in office in October of 2016. So the judge rejected it, and he did so in very strong terms, which I think was appropriate. And perhaps he's trying to send a message that I'm not budging. We're going to trial.
Anybody else have thoughts about Merchan? I mean, I kind of like the way that he is writing these orders. And he did it the same way with the pretrial orders. He did it the same way with some of these gag orders. Like, he is not playing around. I think, what do you think about him sending a message beyond the substance of these orders to say, don't bring any nonsense in my courtroom?
Yeah, this is a judge who's in control of his courtroom, and he's sending that message. What I like about this is he doesn't favor one side or the other. He's an umpire. He calls the balls and strikes, and he's very clear about it. I'm a fan of that style of judging.
I'm too, and I hope that his message gets through to Judge Cannon. That would be as good as it getting through to the litigants in front of him, is that you don't take these things like the Presidential Records Act and dwell on them. You throw them out because they have no merit.
Yeah. So, Jill, despite the repeated slapdowns that Trump is getting in this court, Trump keeps coming back for more. Now he wants the New York trial delayed because of, wait for it, unfair press coverage. The motion asks for it to be delayed, quote, until prejudicial press coverage abates. Make it make sense. Like, what was D.A. Bragg's response? And what do you think the judge will do?
I think the judge will throw it out because it is another one for our maxi dress, which is now going to have to be more than a maxi. It's going to have a train attached to it. So, sorry, guys,
like
but
it.
It's
I like
true.
The image.
It is a good image. And it's, first of all, he even admits, Trump admits, that he created the prejudicial publicity. It's mostly him who's causing it. So it would be perverse to reward him for doing the wrong thing. It's not like anybody else is creating this. It is him. So that's one reason why it should be thrown out. And I think D.A. Bragg's response was right on target and was very strong. There's nothing to this. It cannot be dismissed for this reason. And of course, the publicity is never going to go away because Donald Trump
right.
will keep
it's
on
gonna
creating
abate.
It.
When is it going to abate? So he's basically saying, can we delay this till never? How about never? This
it's
never
his favorite trial date, right? Never.
Yeah, exactly. But never, is that good for you?
I'm glad we can laugh about this. Really, I am, because this is all really serious stuff.
It is. It's awful.
Our laughter doesn't make it any less serious and threatening mm-hmm. to democracy. But I think sometimes you have to take a deep breath and say, oh, gosh, I need something that will help me get through this.
Yeah. I wonder if prosecutors just want to say in their responses that, you know, this doesn't even pass the giggle test. Like, this doesn't even make any sense. And at what point attorneys start getting sanctioned for some of these motions. I wonder when that happens. But if these cases weren't enough, there's more. We learned that Trump will have to sit for a deposition in another case, the ongoing, increasingly messy litigation over his misinformation spreading Truth Social platform. Joyce, what's all that about? And does this mean that we will see Trump under oath again soon?
So, you know, this is so crazy. It's such a rich exercise of irony. The co-founders of Trump's social media company sued him when they couldn't resolve a dispute over ownership interests in Trump Media and Technology Group. So these two guys, it's two former contestants on The Apprentice, which I never watched, but some people may know them, Andy Latinsky and Wes Moss. And they said that in 2021, 8.6% of the pre-merger stock was pledged to them for their work to launch the company. And guess what? They say Trump didn't pay them. Trump media denied them their stake in the company.
Shocking.
Isn't it? It's appalling. You know, diluted their stock, prevented them from selling it. So the lawsuit is in Chancery Court. That's the equivalent of state court in Delaware. And these two have noticed Trump's deposition. And do y'all want to guess what day they've noticed it for?
Don't have to guess. April 15th, the day that the New York trial starts.
Not only tax day, it's the day jury selection starts in Manhattan. And, you know, Trump has very on brand. He's countersued them in Florida last month to strip them of their stock. So, you know, he could also face a deposition down there. Look, I would not put it above Trump to move to delay the start of the trial in Manhattan because of this deposition, but that's not how it works. Criminal trials usually go first. The trial date in Manhattan was there first. So I think it's going to be a while before we see him in the deponent's chair again.
Yeah, and depositions get delayed all the time. Like I wouldn't
all
even
the time.
Like you, but you write the date in pencil on your calendar because you know that it's not gonna stick. So I think you're probably right, and I think with everything else going on, all the judges will, when it comes to picking priority, I think this one will get kicked to the bottom. So I think you're right.
I love our advertisers and getting introduced to them, but Thrive Cosmetics is one that I was using long before they became an advertiser, and it is my very favorite cosmetic product. And I know now that you're using it too, Joyce, so tell us about it.
You know, I am. I didn't learn about Thrive until they started advertising with us. I think they were one of our early advertisers, and I am so grateful I've found them. Whether your style is fresh-faced, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara because it's the one in the turquoise tube that's all over your social media. Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free. They're made with clean, skin-loving ingredients, high-performance trademark formulas, and uncompromising standards. It's easy to see why their bestsellers have thousands of five-star reviews. They certainly get one from me.
We love that Cause is in the name for a reason. Every purchase supports organizations that help communities thrive. With causes like education, cancer research, and working to end homelessness, you'll feel great and look great with Thrive.
I love and highly recommend Thrive's Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara. The flake-free tubing formula dramatically lengthens and defines your lashes from root to tip. And the thing that I really love about it is that it literally catches every lash, but you don't look like a caterpillar. Like, it still looks natural, but it really, really looks nice. People won't say, oh, wow, look at that mascara. They will just say, oh, you look great. And that's perfect for me. Plus, it lasts all day without clumping or smudging or flaking. I get caught in the rain in it and it stays right where it is. But at the same time, it's very, very easy to remove at the end of the day. All you need is a little warm water and a washcloth. The shades are amazing and its nourishing ingredients support longer, stronger, and healthier looking lashes over time.
So you can look great and feel great about contributing to a charity. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. And right now you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/sisters. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/sisters for 20% off your first order. And of course, you can find the link to the perfect look in our show notes. It's now time for our favorite part of the show. We love answering your questions because they are really tough and challenging, smart questions. So keep them coming. If you have a question for us, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com. Or tag us at Sisters in Law Podcast on Threads or tweet using hashtag sisters-in-law. If we don't get to your questions during the show, keep an eye on our Threads feed throughout the week because we sometimes get to answer them there, not on air. And we have some great questions this week. It was really hard to pick, but I have one for you, Barb, from Terry. How long does it take for jury selection, and what is the process of jury selection? That's really good because we have jury selection coming up on April 15th.
Yeah, this is such a good question. And it depends on the case. I have certainly selected a jury in a very simple case that might take less than an hour. You know, if it's a very simple one-count case with a non-famous person, it doesn't take very long at all. But where it tends to take a long time is in these high-profile cases where there's been media coverage, because what you want to avoid is people who are deciding the case based on information from outside of the trial. So, you know, one of the questions that gets asked is, do you know anything about this case? And if so, can you set that all aside and decide the case solely on what you hear here in court? And that's where it gets tricky. So in jury selection, the basics are that jurors may be excused for cause. That is, there's some good cause that they cannot be impartial in this case. So maybe you're related to one of the parties or one of the witnesses, or you have a financial stake. You know, I work for a particular bank and the bank is involved in this case. You would be removed for cause. And the judge has to agree there's a good reason to remove that person. The other thing that the parties get are what are called peremptory challenges. And these are challenges that lawyers get to use really for any reason, as long as it's a non-discriminatory reason. You can't strike people on the basis of race or gender. But otherwise, you really can just use it because there's something about this juror that you think will make them not be fair. I used to be pretty satisfied with most members of the jury as a prosecutor. The people I wanted to excuse were people who didn't seem to want to be there. You know, they said they had a prepaid vacation or they cared for an ailing relative or it was costing them money because they were an hourly worker. I didn't want somebody who didn't want to be there or be in a big hurry to get it over with because need people to be careful. But in a case like the Trump cases that are coming up, the big issue is it's going to be hard to find people who don't have a strong opinion about Donald Trump in the first instance. And so that's what will likely take a long time. They may use a jury questionnaire with some detailed questions so they can do some of this offline without all the people just sitting in the courtroom. But because of Donald Trump's high profile and the fact that many people will know a lot about these cases because of all the publicity, it is likely to take some time to work through and find people who can sit. And for the last thing, for what it's worth, you'd be surprised. People who listen to this podcast are not among this class of people, but there are a lot of people who do not pay much attention to the news at all. And so you think like, you'll never find...
When I'm often shocked at the number of people who I talk to who have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, I've seen it. Like, you know, have you ever heard anything about this case? Nope. What? Really? Nothing? Nope. I have this job and I have a family and all I really focus on is my work and my family or, you know, my
video games.
Yeah, whatever it is. So they're like, and, you know, I didn't love those people either, right? Because I want people who are at least a little bit curious about what's going on in the world. But I'm sure eventually they will find people who have probably heard of Donald Trump. They may even have heard a little bit about this case, but it will be people that both sides are satisfied do not have preformed opinions about the case. Now, you can't always read someone's mind, so it is possible for someone to say, sure, I can be fair, even though they have a strong view. But that's what the purpose of jury selection is, to try to weed those people out.
Thanks, Barb. And now, Joyce, I want to ask you a question from @BeverlyMan19. And she asks, could Jack Smith ask Judge Pryor to use 28 U.S.C. section 292B to reassign the documents case to another judge? And just so that our listeners know, because she may be a lawyer, Beverly Mann 19, that statute says the chief judge of a circuit may, in the public interest, designate and assign temporarily any district judge of the circuit to hold a district court in any district within the circuit. So that would mean that someone from like the Southern District of Florida could be assigned to sit in place of Judge Cannon.
Yeah, so I think this is such an interesting question. Thank you, Beverly. I guess we should clarify that Judge Bill Pryor is the chief judge in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Fun fact, there are actually two Judge Pryors in the circuit. The other one is Jill Pryor. But I think this question is about what the chief judge has the authority to do. And I know there are a lot of people who just have reached the point watching Judge Cannon's rulings where their reaction is, please get this case away from her. But the Court of Appeals can't just swoop in and do that. The case would have to be in front of them, you know, on any of these kinds of appeals we've talked about, a writ of mandamus, a motion to recuse, a straight up appeal on one of the issues, before they would have jurisdiction to act. And the way the 11th Circuit has typically handled it is they've said that they have the authority to order reassignment of a criminal case to another district judge in that district as part of their supervisory authority over the district courts in the circuit. So I think they would normally use a different statute, 28 U.S.C. 2106, to do this. Although it is interesting to note that in some cases where the judges in the circuit have a conflict of interest, they've actually reassigned cases not just to another judge in that district or in that circuit, but to an out-of-circuit judge. I don't think that's the case here, though. I think if we see this happen, the court will just, and I think that they won't do it in a way that's necessarily harsh to Judge Cannon. I think they'll just say she's been reversed a number of times. We think it would be tough for her to set that aside if the case remands to her. So we're going to order that the chief judge in her district court assign this case to a new judge. And I think that's how we would see it handled in almost a collegial way.
Yeah, I actually had a trial in front of a judge from a different state, not just a different district. So it is possible. Our last question is for you, Kim, and it comes from at Robin2XWho, spelled H-O-O. Can districts declared racially gerrymandered still be used in this election, or is there a stay until full resolution? Does it go to SCOTUS?
Oh, yes. So the answer to that is yes, yes, and yes, all of the above. And it has happened in a case that
Alabama
we've talked about.
Alabama voter here.
That's what I'm saying. The case that we talked about called Milligan. There was a determination by a judge that the maps, the congressional maps, were an illegal gerrymander, racial gerrymander. And while that case was being appealed, those who challenged the maps went to the Supreme Court and said, wait, could you please stop this map from being implemented while this appeal plays out? And the Supreme Court specifically, one Brett Kavanaugh said, no, let the map stay. Once the appeals process goes, it's too close to the election. It was not too close to the election, by the way. That's the narrator. And in the end, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which found that it was an illegal gerrymander. But in the interim, there was the 2022 elections that took place on that illegal map. Not just in Alabama, but several other states were stayed with their declared illegal gerrymandered maps in place as well while waiting for the Supreme Court's decision. States like Louisiana, which has, you know, since been changed, but much too late. Justice was delayed and denied to the voters in those states like Joyce. So it does happen. It happens because, I remind you, that the Supreme Court back in 2013 killed the key part of the Voting Rights Act that allowed something to be done about illegal gerrymandered maps before they went into place. And that decision was Shelby County. I'm sorry, Joyce, I'm not trying
also
to beat up on you.
Also from my great state, including my district,
I'm not trying to, under my predecessor, not under me. Yes, I'm not trying to beat up on you. But what would happen in the past is a state like Alabama, when they put forth their new maps, the DOJ would have to pre-clear them first before they were put into place. So any litigation surrounding their legality would take place before they were implemented. That's why that was so important. And you wouldn't get results like this. But now, since the Supreme Court took that away, you do.
Of course, if Donald Trump was president, DOJ preclearance would have still been meaningless, but it wouldn't be now. So thank you for that. And thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Joyce Vance, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Jill Wine Banks. We can't wait for our live shows. We can't wait to meet you and for us to be together, which is always fun. Remember, you can get tickets for the show in Chicago on May 2nd, Detroit on May 9th, and Boston on May 30th. Everyone should go to politicon.com/tour now to get your tickets. They are going fast, and so you really want to act now or you're going to be in the last row. Although all of the venues will let you see us from the last row.
We'll still love you. We'll still love you. We'll talk really
loud.
We'll
love you even more.
Honey,
even more for doing that. Really, truly, we will.
Shout out to the people in the back row.
Please show some love to this week's sponsors, OneSkin, Wild Grain, Honey Love, and Thrive Cosmetics. You can find their links in the show notes. Please support them because they make this show possible. Please follow hashtag sisters-in-law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you, like me, who are Android users, listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really does help others to find the show. See you next week with another episode, hashtag sisters-in-law. I think it's funny that you said you put it in pencil in your calendar because Gen Z, Gen X.
I'm old.
They don't know what that means.
They don't know what that means. You mark it tentative in your calendar.
Old. It's like when the other day I was, a little while ago, I posted with reference to Donald Trump saying, well, I don't want to post, you know, $400 and some odd million. Can I post $100 million? And I said, this isn't let's make a deal. He's not Monty Hall.
Oh, gosh.
And then I was just like, oh, I just dated myself mad. Like,
every
I didn't
day
even know.
Class.
I didn't know that was a, that it let's make a deal had been rebooted. Like, I didn't even know that. I only knew the one I used to watch with my mom every week.
As a law professor, Joyce, I'm sure you get this too. You make some, you think, clever joke, you know, like Ferris Bueller, 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 and they look at you like, what the hell are you talking about?
I have no idea. I have actually done precisely that. Bueller? Yeah. Anyone?
Yeah, and you think you're hilarious. Then.
Yeah. What are you talking about? And they just look at you like you're a moron.
Yeah.
When I worked at CPS, they put out a list every year of things that you should not say. You should not say you sound like a broken record.
Yeah, right. What? What are you talking about?
Bueller. 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 Bueller.